If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
One of his most powerful critics was Lord Byron. Lord Byron, for various reasons, didn't like West at all. And he described him as Britain's best painter and Europe's worst.
That was Lloyd Grossman discussing the Georgian artist Benjamin West.
The only sort of light at the end of the teaching tunnel for all of them was the idea that they could, while they were teaching, be writing and perhaps one day support themselves through writing, which they did manage to do.
And that was Claire Harmon talking about the Brontes. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo, and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our second podcast of October 2015. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our first interview this week is with Lloyd Grossman. Lloyd is well known as a TV presenter and for his work in the food industry. But he's also a historian and has just written a biography of the 18th century painter Benjamin West, a key figure in the Georgian art world. I paid a visit to Lloyd at his London offices to find out more about a man who had a profound impact on the British cultural scene. So who was Benjamin West and where had he come from?
Benjamin West was one of the most extraordinary figures of the 18th century. He was born on the edge of the frontier in Pennsylvania in 1738. And he rose to a position where by the time of his death in 1820, he was the most famous artist in the English-speaking world, second president of the Royal Academy, and also celebrated in Germany and France, you know, an artist of great international stature. It's almost a story that sounds as if it belongs to fiction rather than fact, you know, from humble beginnings to being the friend of George III and the confidant of many of the most powerful and important people in Britain in the early 19th century.
So he's born in America, but he comes to Britain fairly early on in his career, is that fair to say?
He comes to Europe as a very young man, and as almost the first American to go through that cultural rite of passage known as the Grand Tour. So when he's in his early 20s, some very rich patrons in Pennsylvania decide that he should be sent to Italy. And of course, going to Italy was a major part of the education, particularly of British grandees, and to a lesser extent, of Americans who aspired to that, because it was felt that Italy was the source of Western civilization. Rome was culturally the most famous and potent city in the world. And generally, people from the elite believed that a visit to Italy was indispensable to confront the great art of the ancient world and the art of the Renaissance in person was an indispensable part of the process of finishing someone who was going to be part of the ruling class. And West was one of the very first Americans to take part in this, and was certainly the first American artist to go to Italy to confront great works of art face to face.
So where had he learned to paint then? Because he obviously hadn't been taught originally in Europe. Was there much of a tradition of painting at this point in the American colonies?
There wasn't a tradition of painting in the American colonies. There were quite a few itinerant artists who came from Europe to the richer parts of the colonies. I mean, by the time that West was a young man, in the 1740s, 1750s, Philadelphia, which was the closest big city to him, was quite a significant metropolis. I mean, it was the most significant English-speaking colony in the New World, and probably the richest. So there was a demand principally for portraits, because having your portrait commissioned was regarded, you know, as a really big sign of success. And to that extent, the people in Philadelphia were copying the behavior of the aristocracy back home in England. So there was a demand for portrait painting, and itinerant English artists were attracted to the colonies to fulfill this demand. West was largely self-taught, but because he had a great deal of natural aptitude, he quickly attracted the attention of these itinerant artists and therefore got a limited amount of professional training from them.
And so what brings him public attention when he does finally come to Britain? What gets him such an elevated status that he can work for George III?
West was a very, very attractive person. And quite often, and I found this slightly puzzling, quite often, you know, the history of art, the discipline of art history, likes to concentrate on what they call the formal qualities of pictures, namely the picture itself. What happens inside the frame? How well is it painted? How interesting is the composition, and so on? But there are a lot of extraneous factors that are hugely important. West was very good looking. He was a very nice person to be with. He was socially very adept. All those sorts of things help artists to be successful. I think it's very naive to believe that the only thing that matters in terms of success is whether an artist is a great technical artist or not. Yeah, that is important, but it's also important that they are people who have skill at public relations, at getting to know the right people. And wherever West went, from the time he was a young man, you know, he went from a very small town to a bigger one, to Lancaster, Pennsylvania, then to a bigger one, to Philadelphia, then to Rome, and then from Rome to London. And wherever he went, he was always taken under the wing of some of the most important people there. That is one of the keys to his success. People liked him and they wanted to help him.
So does he end up mixing with the leading British artists of the day then?
Yes, he suddenly, you know, from Mr. Nobody from nowhere, suddenly, by the time of the foundation of the Royal Academy in 1768, he's one of the small delegation of artists, including Joshua Reynolds, the biggest name in the land. He's one of the small delegation of artists who goes to George III with the petition asking for the establishment of the Royal Academy. So his rise, his trajectory is very, very steep, really steep. And he's so successful that he, of course, arouses a great deal of animosity. And the animosity against him has always bedeviled his critical reputation.
So even now, that kind of animosity from Georgian times is still hampering him in some way?
It has lessened over the last 30 to 40 years, but certainly during the 19th century and in the early 20th century, he faced a lot of very, very severe criticism. I mean, the Victorian critic Walter Thornbury called him the monarch of mediocrity. And one of his most powerful critics was Lord Byron. Lord Byron, for various reasons, didn't like West at all. And he described him as Britain's best painter and Europe's worst. So West had a lot of critical artillery thrown at him. And it's taken quite a long time for a more considered judgment of his work to be accepted.
And I believe that West had a specific role as a history painter for George III. What does that entail?
Well, his title as history painter to the king is an honorific, but it also came with a certain fee. I mean, he was paid, I think, about £1,000 a year to be history painter to the king, which was a considerable amount of money. So it brought some money, some social cachet, and a certain number of commissions. What one's got to remember is that the world of art in the 18th century was incredibly hierarchical. History painting, which is not the painting of contemporary events, but is the painting of subjects from the Bible, mythology, and ancient history. History painting was regarded as the most rarefied, highbrow, desirable type of art. So to excel as a history painter was something that every artist aspired to. There was one drawback, though, which was it hardly paid. The British didn't want to buy history paintings. They wanted to look at them. They wanted to buy portraits. And most 18th century artists were constantly moaning about the fact that while they aspired to be history painters, they were stuck in the drudge work of painting portraits. West, thanks to his patronage from George III, was one of the very, very, very few artists who was able to concentrate mostly on grand history painting.
And I don't know, I suppose this may not actually qualify as one of his history paintings, but the painting for which he's best known of now, the Death of General Wolfe, what is it about that painting that made it so influential and so important?
It's one of the most revolutionary paintings of the 18th century, which is almost hard to appreciate now because it just looks, to us, it looks rather conventional. Because we're used to reportage. We're used to seeing photographs and paintings and engravings and prints of contemporary events. But it was absolutely revolutionary in the context of the 18th century for a few reasons. Number one, it broke the convention that the most heroic events should be portrayed as if they took part in the dim and distant past, and that great heroes should be portrayed wearing togas, for example. Because it was thought that contemporary dress was both very sort of short-lived and rather demeaning. And it's well known that when it was first mentioned to George III that West was going to paint the death of General Wolfe in contemporary dress, George III said, it was thought very ridiculous to exhibit heroes in coats, breeches, and cocked hats. Namely, people expected heroes to be portrayed in a timeless way. So West broke the mold by doing a very, very grand, grand painting of a contemporary event in contemporary clothes. And this was part of a big shift in attitude about realizing the value of what was contemporary. And to me, this is part of the whole development of a modern attitude. You know, what does it mean to be modern? You know, what is being modern? And I love the phrase of the French philosopher Michel Foucault, who says that modern, being modern is about heroizing the present, namely thinking that the present is as valuable and as heroic and as epic as anything that happened in the past. And this was a huge intellectual shift that happened in the 18th century. People suddenly began to think, actually, we don't have to spend our lives looking over our shoulders. being nostalgic about how great the Romans and the Greeks were. We're really good. We are valuable. We are worthy of epic. And to me, that's the most important thing about The Death of Wolfe. It is a painting that says what's happening now has epic qualities.
And what you said about George III suggests that not everybody at the time appreciated this new approach to painting. So when West had first painted this painting, what kind of reception did it receive?
Before the painting was exhibited to the public, there was quite a lot of theoretical objection to it. I mean, for example, Joshua Reynolds, who was president of the Royal Academy, really warned West not to do it. And his words were something like that such innovations would cause, and I think his phrase was repulse or ridicule. So he was saying to West, please don't do it. Don't do it. And West was absolutely committed. And part of this was his American pragmatism. He was very committed to painting the event in a contemporary fashion. And it was unveiled at the exhibition of the Royal Academy in 1771, and it became a huge popular success. I mean, a massive popular success. Mm. It was the painting of the exhibition. It was the painting that everyone talked about.
It fitted in with the zeitgeist, I guess, at that time.
Yeah, West was very good at being just ahead of the curve. Before he developed this style of contemporary history painting, he was also at the forefront of the previous movement in painting, which was international neoclassicism. And towards the end of his life, he became a major figure in the development of the romantic style of painting. West got the zeitgeist unbelievably well. And as an art historian said to me, he had very sensitive antennae. You know, West was not terribly intellectual, he was not very articulate, but he knew what was going on. He had a great sense of what people wanted. And with The Death of Wolfe, gosh, he really fulfilled a popular demand.
Do we know how he actually researched this painting? Did he actually try and find out exactly what had happened when Wolfe was killed?
Well, he certainly knew one of the principals, General Monckton, because he had painted Monckton a few years previously as a portrait. The fascinating thing about The Death of Wolfe is that whilst it appears to be a work of reportage, it is very literally, it is highly inaccurate. Wolfe did not die surrounded by all his adoring officers. He died very quickly in an obscure part of the battlefield. At least one or two of the participants in the picture weren't even in North America at the time. The picture features very prominently a Native American in the foreground. There were no Native Americans at the Battle of Quebec. But what West was doing, and this is quite a difficult concept to get our heads around, is that he was looking for a deeper kind of truth. The 18th century was less obsessed with literal truth and more obsessed with a sort of inner truth. You know, they didn't care so much about the details of what actually happened on the day. But they wanted a kind of core of truth, truth as it should have been. So, for example, West very prominently put a North American Indian in the foreground because that would immediately convey to viewers, hey, this is an event that took place far away in North America. And it also added a hint of the wilderness and exoticism, which was very appealing. It helped to draw people into the picture. So literal truth wasn't really terribly important to the 18th century.
And how much did this painting actually do for Wolfe's own posthumous reputation?
Wolfe's posthumous reputation was still riding very high, even in 1771. He died in 1759. Even in 1771, he was one of the great imperial icons because he was an imperial martyr. And almost from the time of his death, I mean, within weeks of his death, people were writing poetry about him. And he was being talked about almost in Christ-like terms. You know, people talked about Britannia mourning the loss of her son, just like the Virgin Mary and Jesus. So Wolfe was a superstar. His posthumous reputation was riding high. This painting both capitalized on his posthumous reputation and helped to reinforce it. And there was one critic who said that West was always going around talking about Wolfe, my Wolfe. as if West had made Wolfe's reputation and not the other way around. So it's kind of interesting, you know, how much of a push did Wolfe give to West's fame? How much did West's painting contribute to Wolfe's enduring fame? It's an interesting conundrum. Yeah.
Do you see any parallels perhaps with like the modern situation where you get a film of a famous historical event that for many people becomes a reality?
Yes.
Do you think this painting in some ways did the same thing for, say, the general public?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there is a real line of succession between the death of Wolfe and, firstly, many subsequent paintings, you know, like Picasso's famous Guernica mm-hmm. painting, and the modern sort of biopic feature film, which is framing contemporary or near contemporary figures in a kind of heroic historical mold. Mm. So, you know, this is all part of the mechanism of fame and celebrity and heroism, which, you know, we're surrounded by now.
And in the article that you've written for us, you talk about this Georgian popular history boom. How does that connect to West's painting of Wolfe?
Well, part of the success of the death of Wolfe was to do with the growth of historical consciousness in the 18th century and the popularization of history. You know, prior to the 18th century, history was mostly a pretty dull chronicle of ruling dynasties and kings and queens and battles, and you know, it was mostly aimed at an elite audience. Beginning in the 18th century, just before the first half of the 18th century, a new type of history writing, philosophical history writing, pioneered by Voltaire in France and David Hume in Britain, suddenly began to look at history as a wider, more popular thing. You know, history was not just about kings and queens and generals. History was about a much wider range of people, and history became about the history of society. So there was this growing demand, you know, fueled by the growth of the middle class and rising literacy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There was a huge popular demand for a new type of history, which was satisfied by a new school of history writers, and also with West, by a new school of history painters.
From your own point of view, what's your favourite Benjamin West painting?
My favourite Benjamin West painting has to be The Death of Wolfe, because it's one that I've been familiar with since childhood. But I think his whole body of work is so big. I mean, I think there are 600 pictures or something like that, that amongst them, you know, like any of the prolific 18th century artists, yeah, there is a lot of dross in there, but gosh, there are some real gems which deserve to be rediscovered.
And do you think he ranks with the likes of, say, Gainsborough, Reynolds, Hogarth, some of the names that perhaps get a bit more credibility these days?
I think in many ways he does. He did something very different. I mean, he wasn't as intellectual a person as Reynolds. He probably wasn't as easy and graceful a person as Gainsborough. He certainly wasn't as witty a person as Hogarth. But he brings a commitment to the here and now, which is a very important component of 18th century history. And I think he deserves to be celebrated for that.
And is his work for the Royal Academy, do you think that's well enough known? Because he's obviously the president of that.
He was a very long-term president of the Royal Academy. And I think as we approach the 250th anniversary of the founding of the Royal Academy, we will see more attention paid to West's work as a sort of cultural leader and a cultural inspiration.
Do you feel a kind of kinship with him as a transatlantic person, I guess, yourself, navigating between the North American and the European worlds?
Yeah, I think that West's transatlanticism is quite an important part of his character. And of course, that resonates with me. Although I would say probably at the time that he came over here, remember when he came over here, this was, you know, before the American Revolution, Americans were regarded as kind of a variety of English person. They weren't really, they didn't have a separate national identity. So it, in many ways, West kind of exemplifies this amazing period in which there was a more seamless relationship, I think, between the East Coast of the United States and Britain. But certainly, as an American who came to Britain and settled here and contributed to the country, yeah, I do feel a kinship with him.
Did things change with him after the colonies became independent? Was he viewed then differently in Britain?
The issue of West's Americanism versus his Britishness and whether he was an American patriot or not is quite a thorny one. Certainly, he was not terribly political. And even in his letters home back to the state, he very rarely mentions the American Revolution, other than in very oblique terms. He occasionally raised the question of returning to the United States, but that was only when he thought things were not doing very well over here. Certainly many people thought that he was kind of a closet Republican, and this was fueled when he made probably a slightly ill-advised visit to France in 1803 and became a little bit too cozy with Napoleon. And so he was distrusted by some at the court of George III. But whether he really harbored Republican sympathies or not is something we need to do more work on.
That was Lloyd Grossman. Lloyd's book, Benjamin West and the Struggle to be Modern, is published in the UK today, the 8th of October, by Merrill. In the US, it will be published next week, also by Merrill. And if you'd like to hear Lloyd speak in person, then you can do so at our History Weekend event, which runs from the 15th to 18th of October in Malmesbury, Wiltshire. There are still a few tickets available for Lloyd's and many other talks, and you can purchase them, as well as find out more information, at historyweekend.com. And I should mention that we have a late addition to this year's programme, who is one of Britain's best-known historians and broadcasters, Simon Sharma. Simon will be talking about his new book and TV series on British art through the ages on Sunday the 18th of October. Tickets are selling fast, but there are still some left, so if you'd like to come to that talk, make sure you visit historyweekend.com as soon as you can. And back to Lloyd Grossman. He has also written an article on the Georgian history boom in the November issue of BBC History magazine, which has just gone on sale. Also in this month's edition, there are articles on the Anglo-Saxons, Second World War spies, the Celts, and the Royal Navy's role in the American Revolution. You can get hold of our November issue now, in all good newsagents and in our many digital formats.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now it's time for the latest history news with our digital editor, Emma McFarnan.
A medieval mass grave containing around 50 skeletons has been discovered in the West Midlands. Shallow graves about half a metre deep were unearthed at what was once a medieval pilgrimage site around Lichfield Cathedral in Staffordshire, where an almshouse once stood. The almshouse was used by pilgrims worshipping the tomb of the 7th century St. Chad of Mercia. The bodies were discovered laid on their backs in rows covered in dirt. Archaeology Warwickshire said it had expected to uncover graves on the site, but was surprised by the, quote, volume and quantity of what was found. In other news, a secret staircase to the roof of the gatehouse at Battle Abbey is to open to the public for the first time, giving visitors an unparalleled view of the site of the 1066 Battle of Hastings. To mark next year's 950th anniversary of the clash, the crumbling 14th century stone staircase is to be restored and a new platform installed over the roof. Visitors will have an unrivalled view of the scene of William the Conqueror's victory. According to English Heritage curator Roy Porter, it is, quote, almost the only spot from which you can make any sense of the accounts of the battle. The room had been used as office space since English Heritage took over the site in the 1980s. The secret staircase to the roof of the gatehouse was discovered behind panelling in an arched cupboard in the staff room. The gatehouse is today home to the Museum of Monastic Life, where visitors can learn about the monks who once lived at Battle Abbey. Meanwhile, the ghost of Henry VIII has reportedly been spotted by members of the Welsh rugby squad at a hotel near their base in Twickenham. A number of players claim to have spotted the spectre of the Tudor monarch at Oatlands Park Hotel in Weybridge, which was built in the 19th century on the site of a 16th century palace that Henry VIII constructed for his new queen, Anne of Cleves. Anne of Cleves probably never lived at the palace during the short time she was Henry's wife, but it is believed that Henry secretly married his next queen, Catherine Howard, in the palace chapel. The palace was also popular with Henry VIII's daughter, Elizabeth I, who used it as a hunting lodge. The Welsh rugby team is staying at the Oatlands Park Hotel in the run-up to their Rugby World Cup meeting with Australia. The hotel reportedly has a history of guests complaining of extreme temperature changes, and a number claim to have spotted a so-called grey lady in various rooms.
Each month in the magazine, we run an article called History Explorer, where we visit a location of historical importance in the United Kingdom. For this month's edition, we've turned our attention to West Yorkshire, home to the Bronte sisters, and an area that inspired some of their celebrated Victorian novels. Our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman, headed up to Bronte country in the company of Charlotte Bronte's latest biographer, Claire Harmon.
So Claire, we're sitting in what is now sort of known as the back garden of the Parsonage Museum. You've recently written a biography of Charlotte Bronte. Mm-hmm. I think probably firstly, why did you choose Charlotte out of all the sisters to focus on for your book?
Well, although the Bronte family are, of course, thought of as a unit, I mean, they're one of the most interesting and prolific literary families ever, certainly in English literature. I mean, they're the ones that really stand out. Each individual member of that family was quite different. I mean, they loved to be with each other. They longed to be home. They were not very sociable as a group. But then within their own little group, they were profoundly individualistic people and writers. And Charlotte Bronte's works are very different from those of her sisters, although, of course, they're within the same kind of range of experience. And, I mean, Anne Bronte's novel, Agnes Grey, is extremely like Jane Eyre. It was written before Jane Eyre. But you know, Charlotte's got a very individual take, and her books are my favourites amongst the Bronte sisters' books.
Okay, so, going back to the very beginnings, when do they come to Haworth? When do they, you know, start living in this house?
Well, they came here in 1820 from a parish called Thornton, which is only a few miles away. But it's nowhere near as high up on the moors as Haworth. And Haworth has a peculiar sort of character, partly from its situation and partly from just local weirdness. but the Brontes came here really because it was a promotion for Reverend Bronte, but the children were all very small. Yeah. He had six children at that date. And in fact, his youngest child, Anne, had just been born. So they were, sort of gaggle of small children and his wife. and it was a big enough house for them to live in. They'd been in rather small accommodation in Thornton. But Patrick Bronte, the father, was very happy in Thornton, and it was the place where he had more friends. And really, when they came to Haworth, their sort of social isolation became more intensified because there were various, you know, contentions with the nonconformists and the dissenters and even the Methodists. And Patrick Bronte felt a bit embattled as the established church minister.
Right.
And, you know, the Haworth people were a bit unwelcoming, I'd say. He was an Irishman, and he was a bit odd. And then his wife died the next year, so there was no time in which Mrs. Bronte was able to sort of make the family look more normal or to integrate with the parish. So, I mean, they were bereaved horribly very soon after arriving in Haworth, and really they just became more of a sort of sealed-off unit in the parsonage, which is, as you can see, physically isolated from the village.
Yeah.
You know, it's stuck on the, it's between the moor and the village. And what stands between it and the church is a load of graves. So, you know, they moved here in 1820, looked out of their windows, and what do they see? A heck of a lot of dead people, and then the church, and then the village beyond it.
Yeah, and like you say, they were bereaved very, very early in life, and the two elder sisters also died quite young in life, didn't they? And but Patrick himself, he was a writer, wasn't he?
You could say so.
He wrote.
He published.
Yes. Yeah. Do you think that's kind of where their early inspiration, sort of for writing, came from?
Very probably, because he had, you know, he had a little bit of talent, but he had a massive ambition to be published and to be sort of loved really as a writer. I think he wanted his verses to really be effective, and they were moralizing verses mostly, but he also had a very strong romantic streak, and I think his personal ambition, frustrated though it was, meant that he was very sympathetic to those traits in his children. So he you know, he was not the usual Victorian paterfamilias at all. You know, so many Victorian women writers had fathers who were batting them back, but actually the Brontes' father, although he was very strange, he was an eccentric man, he was not at all, he didn't keep them away from books, he didn't discourage them from reading Byron. I mean, Byron was a scandalous writer to allow your children to read, and certainly one of the books in his library that they would have, well, several of the books were written by him, these little terrible cottage poems and winter thoughts. I mean, I'm saying they're terrible, that seems very rude, but actually they are pretty bad.
So they were sort of grown up seeing their father in print, though.
Yes. And the fact that he had, I mean, he'd had them privately printed. And that in itself, I mean, the fact that they were rather beautiful little editions, you know, with one of them's got a very nice frontispiece, and they're small. And the children obviously liked the look of them. And then when they started making their own, the children made their own tiny books, which got tinier and tinier. And these minuscule books, which were really started off as toys, basically, for their toy soldiers. But, they, you know, that became something that looked awfully like Patrick Bronte's works, really.
And when do we know that children started their own writing? Was that from early childhood?
Yes, already almost as soon as they could write, they were making little books and making little magazines for Branwell's toy soldiers, which is, it's so charming. But then it also became immensely complicated and sophisticated. You know, rather than it just stopping at the level of let's play with the toy soldiers and they can have some literature, the content of the literature really became very, very important, because the soldiers themselves were acting out roles in an imaginary world that was sort of boundlessly inventive. It was particularly Charlotte and Branwell, the two older remaining children after Maria and Elizabeth had died, as you say, you know, aged about sort of 10 and 9, they were leading the two younger children, Emily and Anne, along with these imaginative games. And you know, they had a whole, I mean, Branwell drew maps for it. They had a kind of massive geography of it. They each had their own land, and then they conquered more lands. It was sort of based around African and vaguely Mediterranean countries that they'd read about in periodicals of the day. And, they peopled it with some of the famous statesmen of the time, and Charlotte's huge hero was the Duke of Wellington, so he kind of appears in all sorts of weird, like, superhero forms. He's like Duke of Wellington mixed with, you know, Superman, basically. and the stories that emerged from that were just so complex and gripping. And that's they lived in that world, really. Mm. They were physically in this parsonage here, but they were in their mental life collaborating in this very, very engrossing and sustaining private fantasy.
Do you think that the death of their mother obviously would have had a huge impact on them? Do you think it maybe encouraged this sort of fantasy world even more, do you think, a sort of a solace from, you know, what was happening in the real world?
Yes, I mean, I should think so, because it must have been appalling. I mean, losing their mother in 1821 and then the two older sisters who were beloved, and Maria, the eldest sister, who was only 12 when she, or perhaps 11 when she died, she had been a little mother, you know, she'd taken over the sort of maternal role. And then to lose her in 1825 was, you know, just appalling. I think then Charlotte ended up being the eldest child, and she'd been in the middle of the family before. And, you know, she had no sort of natural maternal leadership qualities of that kind. She didn't feel at all at home in that. And I think certainly, you know, they were escaping from all sorts of things in this fantasy world. And also part of the total boredom of life, you know, when you don't have very much apart from each other. And also they didn't have contact much with the village children, so they were really at home.
So were they educated here?
For the most part, they were. Branwell was almost entirely, well, he was entirely educated at home, being the boy, and his father had been a teacher as a young man, so, you know, it was quite a natural step to tutor his son at home, because Patrick Bronte was as good as any other tutor would have been. The girls, because their aunt had come to live with them after the mother died, so Aunt Branwell was this rather frosty but good-natured aunt, and she did teach the girls a bit, but again, she wasn't really qualified to do much for them. And the girls, it was clear from an early age, they were going to have to earn a living when they grew up. And the only living that they could really plausibly attempt to earn would be as a teacher or a governess.
Right.
For a middle-class girl, that was really, there wasn't really much else one could do that was respectable and would just about sustain life. It's interesting that they weren't encouraged to think of getting married as a way out of that.
I was wondering that actually, yes, whether that was an option.
Because from the start, I mean, the family seemed to think, okay, you know, everybody's got to be prepared to support themselves. So it's a very sort of honourable way to be thinking, and thinking of as a group like that too, not thinking, oh, we've got a pretty one, she'll get married, you know, we've got a one who's a bit of an egghead and she'll, you know, she'll become a teacher. They were all treated in the same way. And the girls, well, Charlotte had been at school when her elder sisters died, and she didn't stay there much longer after their deaths. So she and Emily went to school in Lancashire briefly. Then they both went to school in nearer to home in Merfield in South Yorkshire, well, Southwest Yorkshire, and Anne went there too. But they all had very brief school careers because of the expense of it.
Yeah.
So Charlotte was really only at school for about 18 months as a teenager, and she rattled through everything that was available to be learnt, got all the prizes, and then prepared herself to disgorge that knowledge into some other poor kid.
I mean, how did they feel about the fact that they would need to earn their own living and you know, Charlotte would have to become a governess? You know, how did that sort of feel?
Well, I think they were fatalistic about it. I don't think any of them was you know, egotistical enough to think that they were an exception to that fact of life, but they hated the idea of going out into the world and having to be away apart from each other, you know, being with strangers, which they all feared and despised, and having to teach, you know, children, some of them, well, none of them liked children at all. Just were the least kind of cuddly teachers you can imagine. So, you know, Charlotte was obviously a terrible teacher. She resented every minute of having to be in a classroom with girls and you know, despised their stupidity and all the rest of it. But she also definitely knew that she was going to have to earn money. And the way that the only sort of light at the end of the teaching tunnel for all of them was the idea that they could, while they were teaching, be writing and perhaps one day support themselves through writing, which actually they did manage to do, but only right at the end of their lives, really.
So how long were they actually teaching for, working for?
Well, Charlotte had, they all had kind of goes at it, and then they seemed to have come to a sort of decision that they would act as a group, and they wouldn't, you know, if one of the other of them was out working, it would allow some of the others to come home and have some time off. And the only one who, of the siblings who was any good at keeping hold of a job was Anne, the youngest, who was by far the most well, she just had a very fatalistic streak, and I think she suffered a lot when she was being a governess, but she just felt she had to really stick at it. Emily really couldn't stand it at all. She had just a few weeks or months teaching at Law Hill in Halifax, absolutely loathed it. And Charlotte taught at Roe Head, which she'd been there as a girl and been actually quite a happy schoolgirl there, but she hated being a teacher there. And then she taught in Brussels for about a year, and again, it was a very perturbing year for her. So, you know, they had these... Charlotte never really was teaching anywhere for more than about a year. And so she'd kind of go off, have a breakdown, come home again, you know, get her strength back up again, feel guilty, go out and do another job and come home. So, but it was not something that she was going to knuckle under and give herself over to.
I mean, it sounds, you know, as... It sounds like they were quite lonely then when they were apart. They sort of worked better as a unit.
Yeah, terribly lonely. I mean, really homesick. I mean, they just really didn't function. It's strange. I mean, very very peculiar. I mean, Charlotte really became, you know, hypersensitive and very agitated. And Emily really could. Emily sort of faded. I mean, physically, you know, weakened. It was a profound neurosis, really, about not being at home. And since she was home, she was absolutely fine.
All three of them drew a lot on their own lives, didn't they, for their books. You've mentioned Jane Eyre. What about, you know, because there's like you said, there's a lot of romance in the books, but it was only Charlotte who actually married.
Yeah.
So, I mean, where were they getting this inspiration from?
You mean, where were they getting the romance?
Well, yeah, it was just that, I mean, they're so powerful, the books, and you think, you know, there must be some sort of inspiration, something that was...
Yes.
You know, inspiring.
Well, exactly, because something like Wuthering Heights, which, you know, a lot of people, if they're asked to say, what's the most romantic novel ever, a lot of people would say Wuthering Heights.
Yeah.
And yet it's a really weird novel in terms of the sort of erotics of it. I mean, you know, you can hardly say that Cathy and Heathcliff are the ideal couple, you know, because it's so violent.
It's very destructive,
I mean, they have a soulmate, you know, they have this feeling of being of one and the same person, basically. But it's not a conventional love story by any means.
No.
It's actually a very brutal and unpleasant book. It's very, you know, it's a huge amount of actual physical brutality. And, I mean, Heathcliff is hardly a delightful character.
He's not your classic hero, is he?
Not at all, no. And he's not meant to be particularly gorgeous. I mean, he's always made into something of a hunk in film versions. But, like, Mr. Rochester is also meant to be quite... sort of choleric and a bit short and strange. You know, they're not the typical romantic heroes, but they feed through to readers as the epitomes of romance.
Yeah.
And it is quite peculiar, but the energy in those books is that of a sort of massive, you know, erotic understanding. And as you say, well, where did this come from? It doesn't seem to have been practical experience.
No.
But, I mean, imaginative, you know, I mean, just a sort of immense rushing towards those ideas. And the Bronte sisters had no sense of what was or wasn't delicate to think about or to write about. They had this untrammeled energy that, you know, there was nothing inappropriate about what they wrote. It wasn't contained within ordinary love story parameters at all. And that's what makes it so... You know, it just sets everybody on fire. It's incontinent.
It's wonderful. You can walk around and you can go into the rooms that obviously the family used. I believe Charlotte's desk, her writing desk, is now back.
Yes.
Here.
Well, the place is absolutely full. It's a really haunted house. I think it's the most powerfully moving writer's house museum anywhere. I mean, I've been to a lot of them, but this has been, you know, it's where so much happened. And it's so present because they were they were an indoorsy family and they were very much a unit. It really contains, I mean, the building contains that sense of their closeness and their interdependence. And there are so many objects that have survived. I mean, clothes, items of furniture, you know, manuscripts, obviously, paintings. All the siblings were very adept draftsmen and women, and Branwell was, you know, a professional painter, or wished to be.
Yeah.
But they were all very, you know, so the walls are full of their drawings and paintings, and it's a really powerfully exciting place to be.
Yeah, very. Yeah, I mean, so what was the actual process of their writing? Did they write as a group? Did they sort of, were they discussing their work as they were writing and getting, you know, feedback and things like that?
It's a bit hard to tell, because Mrs. Gaskell wanted to know about that, she being a novelist herself and a friend of Charlotte Bronte, who's then becoming the biographer. And she was fascinated by the whole interaction of the sisters and how they'd managed to produce their works. And several people, including Charlotte, told her the story of how the sisters used to walk round and round the dining table in the sitting room here at night, in the evening rather, when their father had gone to bed. The father was a man of very regular habits, and he always went to bed at 9 o'clock, would go up the stairs, wind the clock on the half landing, and, you know, say goodnight, children. And that's the point at which they really were free to pace round and round. It was like a sort of, pedestrian mantra-y thing. They could walk round and round. They didn't have to look at each other in the face. They could talk and move and discuss things. And it's not clear whether they really, well, they obviously read each other the works in progress. But Charlotte specifically says that what her sisters told her about Jane Eyre, she didn't change anything in the book because of it. I mean, she took on board their reactions, but she didn't adjust her writing accordingly. So it was more of a sort of sharing than a collaboration. I mean, it was more of a, you know, keeping up with each other. And there had been some years when they were each going out and doing these various jobs, when they hadn't had the chance to keep abreast of each other's progress. And that's why it was so surprising to Charlotte in 1845 when she came across some of Emily's poems, sort of by accident, she said. I mean, I don't know what she was looking for, but in Emily's things, she found these poems that she was just so taken aback by the improvement in quality. I mean, that Emily's poems that she'd always known were good were suddenly astonishing, you know, just, and that's what motivated Charlotte to get the book of poems into print, because she felt this kind of duty to getting Emily read.
Emily died first.
Branwell died first.
Branwell,
actually.
Yes. Out of the sisters, was yes, it? It was yes, Emily.
Yeah.
What sort of impact do you think that had on the remaining two and the rest of the family, really?
Oh, it's absolutely terrible, because I mean, within 9 months, the three siblings, Branwell first, and then Emily, and then Anne, all died. And Branwell's death was something that was obviously shattering, but because he'd been for several years in this kind of decline due to alcoholism and opium addiction, it was not such a surprising and abrupt and appalling death as that of Emily and Anne, who seemed to have died from consumption that sort of came on rather rapidly. In Emily's case, she sort of galloped away in the winter of 1848, and, you know, she was dead very, very quickly. She had a cough at Branwell's funeral in September, and she was dead before Christmas. And so that was appallingly, it was a terrible bereavement for Charlotte, who was only just, she wasn't getting over Branwell, but she was sort of stunned by the whole Branwell decline experience. And then Anne, again, in that very winter, started to show signs of consumption. Anne was prepared to go through all the available treatments, because Emily had not accepted any treatment whatever. Emily had been absolutely intransigent about having any doctors near her. A very cruel thing to do, really, to one's loved ones, is not to let them get anybody to help. It does seem that Emily was sort of fatalistic about her chances of recovering, and not wanting to have any sort of interference, and wanting to have a sort of intensity of life, even if it's very short. So she didn't want to be fiddled with but then on the day that she died, like 2 hours before she died, she said, "I think I'll see the doctor now." You know, obviously it's way too late.
Yeah.
But there was a sort of well, you can't call it stubbornness. It goes so far beyond stubbornness, but a sort of mental, just a tunnel vision. She does display a lot of sort of Asperger's-y traits, Emily Bronte, you know, with the sort of genius that she had, but also this, you know, very difficult temperament. I mean, really, a really unbending sort of temperament. And clearly it sort of intimidated everybody around her, even people she loved most. Mm. They were slightly frightened of her, I think. But anyway, poor Emily died that winter. And then Anne, although she did all the, you know, she saw every doctor that was available, she attempted to get to a warmer climate in order, which would have helped her a bit.
Yeah.
But she died in Scarborough in May of 1849. And then Charlotte was, you know, completely bereaved. Just the silence and the emptiness of the house, really just terrible for Charlotte. I mean, dreadful. Sort of emptying out of all the stuff that had supported her before.
So it was just her, it was just Patrick and Charlotte left here.
Yes, and the servant Martha yeah. Brown and Tabby, the old servant, who was actually too ill to be much use of as a servant at that date. Yeah. But yes, it's very, very quiet. And of course, Charlotte didn't really see anybody much. I mean, she didn't have many friends in the area at all.
No. Did she marry after her sibling's death?
Yes, she did.
How does she meet? I can't remember his name now.
Arthur Nichols.
That's right. Yeah. Had she known him long?
Well, he was the curate here, so she'd known him since 1845 when he came to Haworth as her father's curate.
Mm.
So Arthur Nichols had been, you know, not actually attended to very much by Charlotte. I mean, she sort of was a bit rude about the curates always, and she obviously hadn't taken to him particularly. She quite liked him, but there was no passion for Arthur Nichols, I think one can say, before or after much. I mean, she became very affectionate towards him after they'd married, but it was after they'd married. So it's an extraordinary match for her to have made, because here's somebody who'd invented Mr. Rochester, he'd invented Paul Emmanuel in Villette, you know, and the Moore brothers in Shirley. And she had all these incredible sort of heartthrob romances going on in her books. And she ends up marrying somebody that she just about liked enough, but felt no really strong feeling for emotions for. So it's very, very peculiar. I think what was going on, was this some kind of terrible masochism, or, you know, was she so despairing that she felt she had to?
Was it just loneliness, you know?
Totally loneliness. I mean, the fact that Nichols had been, you know, he was a very known quantity. He'd been here since 1845. She knew that he was steady, you know, he wasn't in any way, you know, sort of vicious or lazy or anything. He was a very good curate in terms of he did his job. He alleviated her father's workload, and she was very concerned about what was good for her father at that date.
Mm.
And he'd known her sisters, not intimately, but she knew that he knew the whole story there. He'd known about Branwell and Branwell's sinking into this terrible sort of dissipation. So she didn't need to explain anything about the family circumstances. He'd been a sort of bystander and an observer. So he was like a sort of cousin or a, you know.
That's comfortable.
Absolutely. There was a familiarity about him. He was a very decent man. You know, he was very private. He wasn't going to go around showing off about her works or anything. In fact, quite the contrary. He rather wanted them to be made less of, you know, so they could have a quiet life. And he did a lot, you know, in the parish. Her father had relied on him a lot to begin with, hated him as soon as he proposed to Charlotte, but then her Reverend Bronte got used to Nichols, and actually after Charlotte's death they became very fond of each other. So that was a good outcome. I mean, that was, you know, you can see why Charlotte chose to do that. And it really did save her from the worst sort of loneliness and solitude. But, of course, it also precipitated her death, because what she died from was a complication of pregnancy.
quite early on, wasn't
it? Yeah, very early on. She'd only been married, well, she was married in the June of the previous year, and she died in March of 1855. She was probably about 3 months pregnant.
That was Claire Harmon and Charlotte Hodgman. Claire's book, Charlotte Bronte, A Life, will be published later this month in the UK by Viking. In the US, it's due to be published next spring. And you can read more from Charlotte and Claire in the November issue of BBC History magazine, which, as I mentioned earlier, is now on sale. Well, that's pretty much it for this week, but please do listen in next time, when we'll be joined by Dan Jones and Helen Castor to talk about a pivotal year in the history of medieval England. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.